This is the lecture tape for January 12th, the year 2000, and we're finishing the book of Ruth with chapters 3 and 4, where Ruth marries Boaz. These chapters now bring the story of Ruth to its climax. With the harvest over and there's no more work for the women, Naomi takes steps now necessary to provide for their future. As the story unfolds, we're given a close look into the life and customs of ancient Israel. There's no way of knowing how common this type of arrangement was, but since Naomi had to explain it, it would appear the role of the kinsman redeemer was unique to Israel. So let's take a look at the preparation. We're in chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" The King James uses the word rest or manoah here, and it means much more than a home. It means a future, a life to continue, a husband, the potential of children, fulfillment in a purpose and role, and financial security. "Is not Boaz, with whom the servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours?" Notice this. In chapter 2, Boaz was called Naomi's kinsman. Now he's being called our kinsman. The author is pointing out that the important relationship has changed now from Naomi to Ruth. Her marriage to Mahalalel had connected her not only with Naomi, but also with Boaz. The role of the kinsman was threefold. He was to restore the family property, to protect the family rights by producing an heir, and a third role, which we don't cover in this story, which would be avenge any wrong done to the family. Now, Boaz knows he's Elimelech's kinsman, yet he hasn't offered to serve as the Gael, or kinsman redeemer. This must have been confusing to Naomi, since Boaz was a man of integrity and honor, and he had already shown extreme kindness to Ruth. So Naomi decides to take the initiative. She tells Ruth that tonight he will be at the thrashing floor. She knew with both the barley and wheat harvest over, it was time now for the thrashing and winnowing. The process of preparing the grain for storage took place on the thrashing floor, and that would be a hard-packed area of ground or clay, usually in a high place, and it would be exposed so that it could catch the evening breezes. The process itself was called winnowing. The farmer would beat the sheaves with a rod or flail, or they would be trampled under the feet of oxen. And then the farmer would take a winnowing fork, which was a five-pronged fork, and scoop it into the grain and throw it up into the air. And with the breeze blowing, the lighter chaff would blow away while the heavier grain would fall back to the ground. And this was the way of separating the wheat from the chaff. Now, it's important to note that at this time, it was not inappropriate that the whole town could participate in the festivities. They would be eating and drinking and dancing, but the women and children would return home before nightfall, and only the men would stay out with the grain in the evening. And this they did in order to protect it, because it would be a time when it would be easy to come in and steal the grain. So it's not inappropriate that women would also be involved in this process. Well, Naomi instructs Ruth to look her very best when she goes there. The English translation of verse 3 says, "Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes." And that's really kind of misleading. These women were poor, and they would probably only have one set of clothing. At most, they would have two, but certainly not a best set. Naomi's instructions are for Ruth to take a bath, and then using spices, herbs, or aromatics of the day, she would make a perfume by crushing it and rubbing it on her skin. And quite often they also wrapped some of these aromatics in a piece of cloth and hung them around their neck. That way, as their body got warm, this fragrance of these would perfume the air. This was done in order to kind of hide the odor of clothing that weren't washed on a regular basis. The clothing that she was to put on is better translated mantle or shawl, and this is a scarf-type garment that would go from head to foot and would basically make her unrecognizable. The most critical information comes next. She says, "Then go down to the thrashing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. She's to keep her presence secret, but watch where he lies down and goes to sleep. Then, sometimes later, when he's asleep, she's to go and uncover his feet and lie down at his feet. The uncovering of the feet was a way of causing them to get cold, in which case he would awaken. But once she'd done that, her task was to complete it, and she was to wait for Boaz to do the rest. The context makes it clear that this was the appropriate way for Ruth to indicate her desire to marry Boaz. The author handles this with delicacy, but he also makes it clear Naomi's plan was not without danger. In fact, it required trust on the godly character of both Ruth and Boaz for Naomi to even suggest that she go there. It is well documented that immoral practices at harvest time were commonplace, and in fact even encouraged by the Canaanite nations around them as part of the fertility rites practiced by their local religions. Ruth answers simply, "I will do whatever you say." Well, verses 6 to 13 then take us to the proposal and the promise. We read that Boaz had been drinking heavily and his heart was very merry. So, with enough alcohol, he lays down and probably fell asleep immediately. Ruth carries out her instructions softly or quietly so as not to disturb or awake anyone. Some time goes by before Boaz is startled and wake up. Maybe it was because he was cold or a noise. Maybe God gave him a dream. But the word that he was startled awake indicated that he was terrified. He sits up and looks around, and behold, a woman is laying at his feet. The New International Version plays it down and simply says he found a woman at his feet, but the Hebrew is closer to the King James, which says, "Behold." It's a very vivid picture. This is something not expected. He's trembling, it's dark, and he asks her identity. She says, "I am Ruth, your maidservant." She takes a lowly place, making it clear that she's not taking anything for granted, and she humbly asks him to spread the corner of his garment over her, since he is the Gael, or kinsman redeemer. Now, this expression is a picture of what a man does for his wife. He wraps his coat around her in care and protection. The Hebrew is actually closer to "spread your wings over your handmaiden." Ruth's already taken refuge under the wings of Yahweh. Now she's asking Boaz to take her under his wing, be her husband, and she reminds him that he is Gael, and she has a right to look at him for this protection. Boaz's response gives us insight into a reason why he didn't act in the role of Gaia before. He says, verse 10, "May Yahweh bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you have shown earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." Apparently there's quite an age difference. We've only suspected it before, but it becomes clear here. It's believed in the commentaries that the youngest he would have been is 40, but they believe that he was closer to the age of 80. Now his response is to call upon the Lord and bless her because of her kindness that she's shown. Now technically, Naomi is first in line for the Gael. By sending Ruth, she is abdicating or passing her right on to Ruth. Ruth could have gone for a younger man, and the word picture we get here is the choice young man. And the way Boaz responds and praises her, the indication is that she could have had any of the young men she wanted, but she put her family responsibility over herself, and for this Boaz is praising her. He continues his conversation in verse 11. "Now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character." He's telling her not to be afraid. Why? Because all the way through this story, we've been reminded that she is a Moabitess. Though she was related to Naomi and ultimately Boaz through marriage, she is still a Gentile. Would he take into account the warnings of the law not to marry Moabites? And remember that the child of such a union was to be excluded from God's presence to the 10th generation? That certainly would be part of it. Turn with me to Matthew 1:5. and I want you to see something that might not necessarily stand out to you. This is Boaz's genealogy, and we read, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Now we begin to see a little more clearly. You remember that Rahab was one of the seven Canaanite nations. She was a Gentile, one of the people in Jericho that God said was to be utterly destroyed. Yet Rahab, because her faith in God, she and her family were spared. And we find out, ultimately became part of the nation. She married one of the spies who happened to be a prince of Judah named Salmon, and she even received an inheritance. And now we see that she is part of the lineage of King David and ultimately the Messiah. So Boaz told her not to be afraid because they knew she was a woman of noble character or virtue. And that brings up Proverbs 31:10. Who can find a virtuous and capable wife? She is worth more than precious rubies. Her husband can trust her, and she will greatly enrich his life. Or Proverbs 12:4, a virtuous woman is a crown to her husband. Verse 12, although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a Gael, or kinsman redeemer, nearer than I. He states emphatically that he's a kin, but there is a problem. Someone is closer in relation than him. Now, we've studied the Levirate marriage, where the law implied, but not actually said, in the case of a childless widow, the next of kin had the duty or the right to marry the woman and raise up an heir to be the descendant. In chapter 25 of Deuteronomy, we also find that that next of kin should actually be a brother. If the brother refused to perform his duty, Deuteronomy makes a provision for the widow to publicly humiliate him, but it doesn't say that anyone else could take his place. This story now adds to our understanding, and there seems to be a proper order as to who can serve as the Gael. The next of kin had the right and responsibility, and only if he declined was it possible and necessary then for another member of the family to take his place. But even that was not indiscriminate. There was a certain order which they must follow. So Boaz, being a man of honor and integrity, tells Ruth, now stay the night. It would have been dangerous for her to return to the city because the gates are closed until sunrise, but he promises to take action in the morning. In fact, he even takes an oath. Did you see that in verse 13? He says, but if he will not, meaning redeem her, as surely as Yahweh lives, I will do it. Now, he doesn't mention marry her, but he speaks emphatically that he will accept the role of Gael and all that it entails. He leaves no doubt in her mind that it'll be settled in the morning, and then tells her to lie down and rest for the rest of the night. Verse 14, so she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized, and he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. This verse in Hebrew reads, he said to her, lie down until morning, and he said to himself, but don't let it be known a woman came to the threshing floor. A woman on the threshing floor was not wrong, but Boaz seems to be concerned that this relationship or this could be misunderstood. He really is interested in protecting her good name. Ruth obeys Boaz, lies back down. I can't imagine that either of them slept, because we find before dawn they are both up. Now Boaz doesn't want his prospective bride to return home to her mother-in-law empty-handed, so he asks her to hold out her shawl and then proceeds to fill it with 6 measures of barley. Now, in the Hebrew, there's no word given for what this measure was, but if we take into account the 2 standard measures of the day and that we've already seen in the book, it would either be an omer or an ephah. Now, the omer is 1/10 of an ephah, and we know that she gleaned 1 ephah in the day, so it would be appropriate that he would give her a gift of like a 6 days worth of gleaning, which would be 24 gallons or 88 pounds. It also says that he put it on her, and if it was 88 pounds wrapped in a shawl, he would help her lift it on top of her head so that she could walk home. Ruth leaves before it's light enough to be recognized, and I'm sure Naomi was anxiously waiting for Ruth to arrive home. In verse 16, Naomi says, how did it go, my daughter? The question in English could have been, are you engaged or not? Ruth tells her what happened, and Naomi says, wait, my daughter, until you find out what will happen, for the man will not rest until this matter is settled today." If what he said hadn't convinced her, then the 6 measures of grain left no doubt that she would have her answer that day. Now they must wait and see who will be their Gaal. Well, the fulfillment comes in chapter 4, 1 through 12, and this section gives us a look into the ancient legal system. We find that Boaz goes to the city gate, and we've talked about this before. In the wall is what's called the city gate, but it's actually rooms. There's 2 walls with a space of 10, 12, 14, sometimes even 30 feet in between it. And that room in the gate serves as what we would say like a courthouse where all the business transactions would take place. The elders of the city and the men would gather there, and if any business was taking place, it would be the appropriate place. Because if you wanted to speak with someone, everyone went in and out the same gate. And so we find Boaz coming early, probably as the gates opened for the day, and waiting for this kinsman to arrive. He eventually comes and is ready to pass either in or out, and Boaz hails him and he says, "Hey friend, come on over," indicating he had business to do with him. And the kinsman comes over, and then Boaz, we find, enlists the aid of 10 elders. That would be the appropriate number to do business. Once the court is in session now, they are ready to do their business. I found it interesting that wherever this near kinsman was going or what he was to do was kind of put on the back burner while they went about their business. Far different culture than you and I serve today. Well, the court in session, Boaz begins by stating his case. In verse 3, he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belongs to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." He begins with the Gael's role of redemption of the land. Now in Leviticus 25, it said Yahweh retains ownership of the land, but Israel received the use and produce of the land by lot as their inheritance. Now in hard times, the land lease could be sold, but it was the legal duty of the next of kin, or the Gael, to redeem the property by purchasing it and then restoring it to the original owner or his heir. If this was unable to be done, then the property automatically returned to the family at the next year of Jubilee. And you remember that that was once every 50 years. Boaz said, "Naomi is selling a piece of land." That would have been Elimelech's portion of the common barley field. Naomi was poor and could not retain her land, so it would be the family obligation to buy the land so it would not be lost to her family. Now, how Naomi was able to sell it is not clear. Normally, without a living heir, Elimelech's land would have gone to the closest male relative, which may indeed be why Naomi was offering the land to Boaz first, since he was a male relative, although he wasn't the closest. Well, after Boaz makes his case, the unnamed kinsman said he will redeem it. Now, Boaz anticipated this, and he was prepared. Look at verse 5. Then Boaz says, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." Boaz says the land doesn't just belong to Naomi, but to Ruth as well. The Gaal must raise up an heir so the dead man's name will not be blotted out from Israel. And a man's worst fear in Israel was dying without an heir to carry on the family name. Well, once the dual role is mentioned, verse 6, the kinsman redeemer says, "Then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, the meaning of the statement isn't completely clear, but the fact that he says he cannot may refer to the financial state. He could maybe manage to buy the land from Naomi, but he's not financially able to take on the burden of 2 widows. But the reason he gives is because it would endanger what he already has. He was willing to add the property to his own, but not take the chance of losing what he already had. This seems to indicate that he doesn't have a male heir at this point. Notice that Boaz points out she's a Moabitess to put extra pressure on the kinsman. Maybe he thought, well, you know, Elimelech had all this until he went into Moab and they got involved with these women. Then all the men died. Maybe I'm not too sure about getting involved with this Moabite woman. Well, the author then adds an editorial comment, because the time that this story occurred and when it was recorded, apparently this custom of the sandal became obsolete. He says, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So we find the sandal remover was actually part of the transfer. It would be like signing the deed. To take off the sandal and hand it to another person in whom favor the transfer is being made was a symbolic act to show that the transaction was now legal and binding. And apparently this was normal practice. Now, when we looked at the Deuteronomy 25 passage, there was a sandal removal situation there. But this was different. It was done to a brother who refused the widow, and there was no mention of another who could take his place. In fact, the removal of the sandal was done forcibly by the widow, who also spit on him as a sign of humiliation because he had not fulfilled his duty. In the Ruth story here, there's no mention why he should be humiliated. In fact, the kinsman took off his own sandal and handed it to Boaz, not as a sign of humiliation, but a sign of passing on the right to the next person, and that made the transaction then complete. Well, with a legal transfer done, verse 9 says, "Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, 'Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or the town records. Today you are witnesses.'" Boaz addresses the elders first and then all the people. Now, there were people from town present there, and they're not just bystanders, but they're actually serving as legal witnesses. There were few written records there, and with enough people, there would be no question. He states that he has bought all that belongs to Elimelech and his sons, and he has also acquired Ruth as his wife. He establishes his right to the family possession, and he accepts the responsibility now to pass on to Mahlon's heir that inheritance. Ruth is called a Moabitess for the last time here, because as a result of Boaz's action and the elders' acceptance, Ruth is now officially part of Israel. The elders then call upon the name of Yahweh to bless this marriage. They ask God to make her like Rachel and Leah. Interesting, Rachel's mentioned first because as Bethlehemites of Judah, they are descended from Leah. Judah was Leah's son. But they asked that God would bless her like Rachel. Rachel was the one who was loved. And together these two women built the nation of Israel. They also pray for Boaz that through this child he would become like Perez. Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. This is interesting because this is also a Levirate marriage, and it's through the son of Judah, Perez, that the royal line comes, which is Boaz, David, and ultimately the Messiah. If you're not familiar with the story of Judah and Tamar, that's in Genesis 38. Well, court is now over, so Boaz would have proceeded with the process then to make Ruth his wife. She didn't automatically become his wife, but he was now given the right to continue on with that process. The result of the marriage was God blessed them with a gift of a son. The emphasis here is upon God's gift. The closing verses then focus on Naomi again. The women of the city come out, and they're delighted at the birth of Naomi's child. She had been empty, now she was once again full. She had no future and no hope, but in this child, her husband's name would be carried on just as if he were her own son. The women pronounce a prayer and blessing, giving Yahweh the praise for his faithfulness. He had not left Naomi without a redeemer. They prayed the child would be famous like Perez. And then they prophesied that the child would mean much to Naomi and that he would care for her in her old age. The praise continues for Ruth, the daughter-in-law that loves Naomi and turns out to be better than seven sons. Seven being the number of completion or perfection. Naomi then becomes the child's nurse or caretaker. That simply says the child was special to Naomi and she was devoted to him. She had expected a lonely old age after all that happened to her, and now, because of Ruth's devotion, everything was different. She belonged to a family once more. She was loved, recognized in the community, and this baby was a symbol of it all. Verse 17 says, the women of the village named the child Obed, or servant, servant of God. Now, it's highly unlikely that the women would name the child, but it's quite possible that they heard what they were saying, and Boaz and Ruth then took their suggestion and made that his name. The verse then concludes by connecting Obed with David. The child who was born as a result of this unique marriage was the grandfather of Israel's greatest and most loved king, that of David. And so it seems appropriate then that the book concludes with a short genealogy, again beginning with Perez, the forefather of the royal family of Judah, who was also born of a Levirate marriage, and ends then with David. Notice, though, that Obed's father is Boaz, not Mahalian. A child of a Levirate marriage carried the deceased father's name and succeeded to his property, but the official genealogy, his true father, was recorded. Throughout this book of Ruth, the author reminds us that it is God who is supreme. And even in lives of people like Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz, God never forgets his purpose. His hand is over all history, from generation to generation, bringing to completion his purposes throughout the ages. You see, history is not haphazard. There is a purpose, and that purpose belongs to God. I love the way this story is presented, didn't you? This time we start with a funeral and end with a wedding. But the purpose of the book of Ruth is to trace the ancestry of David the king, but we also see there's a lot of spiritual truth in this story as well. Ruth was from Moab, and the law said a Moabitess was excluded from the nation of Israel. But because she put her faith in the God of Israel, she was accepted, an illustration to us of God's grace to all Gentiles. Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, is a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ, who paid the price to redeem us and make us his bride. In this story, what the law could not do for Ruth, Boaz accomplished. He so loved her that he made her a part of his inheritance, and that is what Christ has done for us. He willingly took upon himself flesh so that he might redeem us. He paid the price, and he did it because he loved us. And like Boaz, he is the Lord of the harvest. He supplies our needs. He redeemed the inheritance for us, and he gives us rest. Ruth the bride became an ancestress of David, through whose line the Messiah was promised. And like Boaz's mother Rahab, Ruth was a Gentile who married a Jew and became a part of the salvation history. This book may be small, but the story it tells is a part of the greatest story ever told. Well, what are some practical applications? I see a very strong warning in this book. Turning away from God is a serious matter. It cost Naomi her husband and her sons. No matter how difficult circumstances may be, the only place for God's people is in the will of God. When we seek satisfaction from the world, we will pay a high price. But the good news is, even when we blow it, God is willing to forgive and restore those who call upon him. There are consequences, however. Naomi could never again regain the lost time out of God's will, never gain back her husband or her sons. But her joy was restored, and she was once again full. As Naomi's faith was being restored, her counsel to Ruth was to wait. She had done her part, now she must wait for Boaz to do his. I think there's a practical lesson here for us also. It's wise to wait on the Lord and let him work out his purposes. God's will and purposes are very clear to us in his word. After we have done all that we can do, we must trust the Lord to do the rest. And he will never fail us. Isaiah 28:16 says, the one who trusts in God will never be dismayed.